Hey y'all, how's it going? Welcome to the show. It's the show. This is Scott Horton's show. I'm him. Which is, you know, convenient. Alright, should be a good one for you. Trevor Tim's going to be back on the show to talk about NSA-y stuff. And Peter Hart's going to be here to talk about the media. Singular. The medias? Michael Ratner's going to be here, like he's supposed to be yesterday, but some things came up. And he's going to be on to talk about his client, Julian Assange, and some of the other great persecuted truth tellers of our time. So, that should be good, right? But you know what that means. Finally, for the first time, I guess, this year, I've got 3 interviews on the show. Boy, is it a slow start to the year. Anyways, that means I've got very little time to do all of my own complaining. I mean, you know, coverage of the news. So here's that. First of all, along the lines of what we were talking about with our friend Kate Gould yesterday on the show, Harry Reid is dilly-dallying. Thank goodness, on the Iran sanctions. Now, I guess Jim Loeb, he must understand some context. I don't, because, well, I guess, you know, that's why I read Jim Loeb. Israel lobby thwarted in Iran sanctions bid for now. And what looks to be a clear victory, at least for now, for President Barack Obama, a major effort by the Israel lobby and its most powerful constituent, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, to pass a new sanctions bill against Iran has stalled in the U.S. Senate. While the legislation, the Nuclear Weapon-Free Iran Act of 2013, had gathered 59 co-sponsors in the 100-member upper chamber by last week, opposition to it among Democrats appeared to have mounted in recent days. That opposition apparently prompted Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, who controls the floor calendar, to back away from a previous commitment to permit a vote on the measure sometime over the next few weeks. As a result, AIPAC is now reportedly hoping to get the bill through the Republican-dominated House of Representatives instead. Democratic resistance to the bill, which its critics say is designed to scuttle the November 24th joint plan of action between Iran and the so-called P5+1, and any chances for U.S.-Iranian rapprochement, has grown stronger since Sunday's successful conclusion of an implementation agreement between the two sides, and by Obama's explicit pledge to veto the bill if it comes to his desk. Even one of the bill's 16 Democratic co-sponsors, Senator Richard Blumenthal, said this week he saw no need for a vote, as long as there is progress in implementing the 24th Accord. And in fact, here is a previous Iran sanctions co-sponsor, Senator Martin Heinrich of New Mexico, who has been a co-sponsor of sanctions legislation in the past, will not sign on to this one. This is a story in the National Journal. And in fact, what the hell happened to that Huffington Post story? Yeah, because it had a quote in it that I wanted to show you. Let me see. It was a big one from last night about Obama telling the Congress. Yeah, here. Their headline, Obama urges the Democrats, the senators, against sabotage. Oh, man. Wrong link. Oh, they just linked back to their own front page. Anyway, Obama went to, or I guess he had a meeting of senators at the White House and congressmen at the White House and pleaded with them to not pass these new sanctions. And in fact, what, did my Firefox crash and erase all my stuff or something? Where's all my stuff? Because there's also, what's her face? Here, I got it on my Facebook page, I know. Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who you might remember when Netanyahu came and gave his speech to the Congress. She's the one who led all the Democrats in all the standing ovations, where he got a record number of standing ovations for anyone speaking to Congress, I think, ever. And certainly more than they gave the president at his, I think it was his State of the Union, was just before that. But anyway, so she's a hardcore Likudnik, hardcore Israel lobby fanatic. And she's siding with the president on this one, as is Dianne Feinstein, the powerful senator. And in fact, oh, here's the Huffington Post article. Obama urges Senate Democrats to oppose Iran's sanctions in closed-door meeting. And, yeah, it talks about Debbie Wasserman Schultz. I forgot, is she the minority whip? Or maybe, I forgot her position. She may be the minority leader or something in the House, for all I know. What the hell do I know? Well, all they have here is from her staffers, you know, being very careful or whatever, but the reporting is, there's no quote there, but the reporting is that she's sided with the president on this. So it looks like a possible, you know, as Jim Loeb put it, for now, an Obama victory. And again, I want to make it clear that I oppose the very existence of the presidency. And I sure, you know, don't support Obama on anything other than this. And really, I'm of two minds about this, because it is, you know, playing along with the Israel lobby on their nonsense instead of just denouncing nonsense and moving on. This fake ginned-up crisis over Iran's civilian nuclear program. But this is the single biggest outstanding issue. Because, you know, nuclear. That once this is resolved, if we can get it resolved, then it's basically the death knell of the Cold War. There's nothing else to fight about after this, not really. I mean, it might take a little while. You know, from the time the wall came down to the time Gorbachev resigned was 2 years. So it might not be, you know, perfect. And in this case, of course, we're the Soviet Union, you understand, the evil empire. But we don't have to, you know, come down. We just have to end our Cold War. We don't have to, you know, fall apart. That, you know, beneficent side effect if it happens. It wouldn't even be a side effect, but if the empire ended, there'd be no need for this deal. Put it that way. If the empire would fall apart. I was just trying to come up with a, hey, man, wouldn't it be nice if we could have a whole new reset? Call it the redirection. Again. Pivot back and forth again. And there's no need to make enemies. We can just make friends with everybody now. We'll be friends with the Shiite Crescent and with the Sunni, you know, the Saudi kings and all their sock puppets. Why fight? And so I think that the nuclear issue is, I know for a fact, I'm telling you, it's a ridiculous, bogus, non-issue. They're not making nukes. They never were. They're members in good standing of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, unlike the Israelis, who have hundreds of nuclear bombs, you know, that they made out of nuclear material they stole from the United States. It's a big fake crisis, but it's the one outstanding. It's the issue outstanding. And this nuclear deal, in other words, they're going from verifying the non-diversion of nuclear material to any military purpose to extra super duper double plus verifying the non-diversion of their nuclear material to a military purpose. That's it. That's the deal. And then we'll let them live. That's not fair enough. Of course, in this sanctions bill, there's multiple parts to it. First of all, it has the threat of new sanctions, but then it also it defines successful negotiations as an end entirely to their nuclear program, which is never going to happen, which is obviously a deliberate poison pill meant to sabotage the deal. They'll never give up the last of their enrichment. Nor should they have to, anyway. Also, it has the kind of a pseudo-war guarantee to Israel. It says that if Israel starts a war, that by definition, that will be in self-defense, even though, no. And then we have to join in the war with them. Supposedly, it would require a second resolution, but see what happens if it happens. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. Hey y'all, Scott here. So you made a little bit of money in this horrid economy only to find that the Fed has more or less outlawed saving. So into the treacherous waters of the stock market bubble you go. But how to make a little money without too much risk of losing it all? Check out WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who opens a very real window into his main account, updating his subscribers on the facts of and the reasoning behind all his market moves. Follow along on paper or with real money and see what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I shouldn't drink such bubbly drinks during the show. So I have to hit the mute button all the time. Because you just want to listen to a burp show. I had Frank Luntz do a focus group for me. And that's what they said. All right, So, on the subject of Iran's nuclear program, there's, frankly, a pretty groundbreaking article, as silly as that should be to say, in The Guardian by the great journalist Julian Borger, and he's done a lot of great work over the years. I really don't know everything he's written or whatever, but he's a good guy on the national security beat. In fact, he's one of the guys that reported that Ariel Sharon had created his own little office of special plans back in 2002 and 2003 to manufacture fake intelligence in English to stovepipe into the intelligence stream to help lie the American people into war with Iraq. He's got this piece in The Guardian, The Truth About Israel's Secret Nuclear Arsenal. And I sent a reply tweet that included him and Trita Parsi and a few others earlier this morning, pointing out that my only problem with this, and I really think you ought to take a look at this. It's a good article. The Truth About Israel's Secret Nuclear Arsenal. You can find it in the top headlines at antiwar.com today. And what you'll find here is that, my only gripe with it would be that a very low estimate, a double-digit estimate. Now, the U.S. Air Force has estimated in the past between 200 and 400 nuclear weapons. Now, Borger links to NTI.org. who estimate that Israel has approximately 80 nuclear weapons. Let's see, that's the Global Security Newswire. And, it's the Federation of American Scientists, experts Hans Christensen and Robert Norris. Their estimate is 80. And they base their estimate on a 1999 DIA study. That's the Defense Intelligence Agency. Israel is believed to have generated enough nuclear weapons material to fuel between 115 and 190 warheads, according to the authors. The report does not provide a reason why Israel apparently stopped warhead production at 80. But the DIA did not predict any sharp stockpile increases before 2020. Well, Daniel Ellsberg, the heroic liberator of the Pentagon Papers, has said on this show numerous times, because I followed up and verified it and want to make sure I'd be able to find it later if I have to and that kind of thing. Daniel Ellsberg has said on my show repeatedly that Mordecai Vanunu, the Israeli whistleblower who told the truth about Israel's nuclear weapons program back in 1986, that he personally told Ellsberg that they had 600, that Israel had 600 nuclear weapons, including thermonuclear bombs, H-bombs. As Daniel Ellsberg likes to put it, the Nagasaki bomb, which was more powerful than the Hiroshima bomb, an implosion plutonium fission bomb there in Nagasaki, that is the blasting cap. That is the percussion cap for setting off an H-bomb. That's what an H-bomb is. It's the super. That's what they called it back then, the super. And so, I'm not sure. You know what? Maybe Vanunu was wrong about that. Seems like a pretty high number for him to be pretty confident in saying, and for him being Vanunu and everything. So, that's the magic of Twitter, is all of a sudden, hopefully started a conversation between Ellsberg and Borger and others, and maybe they'll follow up on this. I saw Trita retweeted it. Maybe I'll get Dan Ellsberg back on the show. Maybe I'll get Borger on the show. Maybe I'll just email Dan Ellsberg's interview to Borger or tweet it to him. Something. Because, you know, it seems like if it's really true that Israel has 600 nuclear bombs rather than just 80, that, hey, people ought to know that, right? Because it's the truth and everything, if it's the truth. We're going to find out if it is or not, right? All right. So I just thought I'd point that out. After, you know, all the boo-hoo crying by Israel and their partisans about Iran's civilian nuclear electricity program and their medical isotopes that they're making over there. Oh, boo-hoo, it's such a threat to Israel. Israel's armed to the teeth with nuclear bombs made with material they stole from America. They're the regional hegemon, not helpless, tiny, little, surrounded by enemies, although they do their very best to make everyone hate them. And in fact, that's going to be, you know, part of our discussion with Peter Hart. What gets lost in the discussion of Ariel Sharon is he's one of the guys that made sure that Israel would soon destroy itself, instead of creating a reality where it can thrive for the long-term future over there in the Middle East. Oh, whatever, he's a hero, he's a peacemaker, he's wonderful, because he's a politician. And all politicians are the best people of all, everybody knows that. Yeah, okay. Somehow, that became the assumption. But nobody ever proved it. Not that I ever heard. Okay, and then there's new pictures. I got so much Iraq news and so little time here. First of all, Winslow Wheeler wrote a thing I was surprised to see, happy to see, in Counterpunch, one of Robert Gates's more real legacies, 500,000 dead Iraqis. And I don't have time to go through all this with you, but I just think, you know, again, like Ariel Sharon, these guys are butchers. They're the worst people on the planet, these politicians, and particularly in the American and Israeli government. And yet Robert Gates, we all respect you so much because you were the secretary of something one time. The guy's a child killer. He kills children. Oh, you're a secretary of something. Wowee, I'm so happy to talk to you. Yeah, well, his real legacy is child killer. And that's the fact, whether history really looks at it that way or not, you know, I don't know. But for my part, I think it's worthwhile to note contemporaneously that Robert Gates is a child killer and not someone to be venerated. And anyway, so this is right before he became, this would have been a couple years before he came, became the Secretary of War. This would have been under Rumsfeld in one of the two battles of Fallujah in 2004. There's the spring and then the fall again. And these are photos of Marines burning and posing with corpses, desecrating corpses. And supposedly they're going to be under investigation now, whatever. It was broken by the Hollywood gossip site TMZ. They have the pictures if you want to go look at them. And what's funny is, with the news that Al-Qaeda hoisted their black flag and the Sunni tribes weren't getting along with Maliki anymore and whatever last week, they're running all these articles about Marines saying, well, why did I fight in Fallujah if everything there is now terrible again or whatever? And, of course, with no real context at all. It's ridiculous, the things that people say and think. But anyway, the point is that one of the ridiculous things that one of these guys was saying, well, and they were all repeating more or less the same kind of line. And his thing was, you know, when I was over there, I was there fighting to help the people of Iraq, to save them from those who, you know, would brutally oppress them. And it's like, dude, you're fighting the men of Fallujah in Fallujah. You're the invader. You're the oppressor. The men fighting you were the ones who were fighting to protect the people from the oppression, not you. Jesus Christ. Well, a Republican told me something one time, and I just can't think straight ever again. Whatever a Republican says must be right. Here we are. We're 10 years out. 10 years later. And this Marine talking to the Washington Post, I think this one was, he just can't be honest with himself. He was there to protect the Fallujans from the Fallujans. Really? Yeah, I killed them all until they were dead. And then the survivors who were there to think that, what? To this day, they're still resisting the authority of the also Iranian-backed government that we put in power in Baghdad? Of their mortal enemies? Oh, what a tragedy. It's almost like my mission was for nothing. The Sunni Arabs of Fallujah were supposed to lay on their bellies and die if that's what Maliki wanted. That's what we fought for over there. Total submission by the losers in the democracy to the winners in the democracy, right? Oh, did no one ever define what the mission was beyond a bunch of pretty slogans about helping the people? How many stories did you hear in the Iraq War about painting schools? Oh, we're painting a school. That really worked on people. You realize that? Might have been you. Oh, gee, a Republican told me that by invading and bombing a country and killing hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people that I'm the liberator. Right, Michelle Bachmann to this day talks about how the Iraqis owe us money. They should have to pay for the cost of their liberation. They're so ungrateful. They have all that oil money. And they're not paying us back after all we've done for them. Wow-wee. Yeah, well, you know, their undertaker industry's been doing great. Past 11 years or so. Past 20. Past 30. The hands of American foreign policy. Yeah, and then we desecrate their corpses, you know, because we love them so much. We're just save these people from those who oppress them. Like this guy whose corpse I'm burning right now. And taking pictures of, posing with it, and smiling. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. What was the only interest group in D.C. pushing war with Syria last summer? AIPAC and the Israel lobby. What's the only interest group in D.C. pushing to sabotage the nuclear deal with Iran right now? AIPAC and the Israel lobby. Why doesn't the president force an end to the occupation of Palestine, a leading cause of terrorist attacks against the United States? AIPAC and the Israel lobby. The Council for the National Interest is pushing back, putting America first and educating the people about what's really at stake in the Middle East. Help support their important work at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And our first guest on the show today is Trevor Tim from the Freedom of the Press Foundation at pressfreedomfoundation.org. Man, I swear you got to fix that. You're driving me crazy. Welcome back to the show, Trevor. How are you doing?
Pretty good. How are you?
I'm doing great. Appreciate you joining us again. And I guess let's start with the big news that Edward Snowden has now joined y'all's board of directors, which I think makes him puts him in pretty good company, huh?
Yeah, it was pretty exciting. We announced just 2 days ago he's going to be joining. You know, on our board already we have Daniel Ellsberg, the famous Pentagon Papers whistleblower, and the NSA reporters who originally wrote the stories were reporters on Glenn Greenwald. So, you know, he's exactly the type of person that we started our organization to encourage to come forward with information and, you know, bring about the type of accountability journalism that's so important in this country. And so we couldn't be prouder to have him aboard.
Cool. Now, I mean, I don't really see one, but I can sort of anticipate that somebody's going to try to bring up a conflict of interest here. Is there one at all?
Well, I don't know what the conflict of interest would be. You know, we started this organization, you know, over a year ago to promote and defend and encourage whistleblowers to come forward and you know, really emphasize that the war on whistleblowers is also a criminalizing of journalism in a sense, because there's no way for journalists to get information to the public without sources. And so, you know, we were calling on news organizations to publish more government secrets in the public interest and for whistleblowers to come forward with information despite the risks. And, you know, Edward Snowden embodies everything that we started this organization for. And so I can't imagine any conflict of interest. You know, it's we think he's a perfect fit.
Yeah, I mean, I was just trying to think like Fox News for a second as far as, you know, Greenwald reporting on the story and then having the guy on the directors and this and that, but whatever. Like you're saying, that's what the whole thing was created for in the first place. So,
And it's not we're not doing the actual NSA reporting. You know, Glenn Greenwald has his own organization and works with other publications. We're more about promoting the ideas around press freedom and how the First Amendment is crucial in reporting on all this, and also how the surveillance can affect journalists. Mm-hmm. And how they could potentially prevent the surveillance from affecting their job. And so that's where Snowden would fit in with us.
Well, I know that Daniel Ellsberg is really excited about what Edward Snowden has done. He calls him his hero and all that. And I know that since I've been talking with Dan Ellsberg back in, you know, starting back in, I guess, 2005, 2004 or 2005, he's always, and I've always tried to give him an opportunity on my show to give a call out directly, a call to action to government employees out there who, you know, whose bosses are committing acts of wrongdoing against, you know, whether it's Iraqis or Afghans or Americans or whoever, that, you know, there comes a time, hey, if you're brave enough to take a bullet fighting for Hamid Karzai's regime, you're brave enough to do a couple of years in the brig for liberating some documents for the American people. And so I think Snowden is basically Ellsberg, his dream come true, exactly what he was asking for all this time. Was this time for some of you people in positions of authority to choose whose side are you on, the people and their Bill of Rights, or the particular politicians and appointees who you happen to serve under, which are, you know, sort of beside the point when it comes down to it?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Dan Ellsberg wrote a great blog post for us, actually, just last week, talking about the difference between the contract you sign, the secrecy contract you sign when you start working with classified information, and the oath of office you take to uphold and defend the Constitution. And really that oath, as Ellsberg stated, you know, should really overtake any contract that you sign to protect secrets. If those secrets end up, you know, trying to hide wrongdoing or corruption or lawbreaking. And that's exactly, you know, how Ellsberg reacted back in the late 60s and early 70s when he saw what was happening with the Vietnam War and leaking the Pentagon Papers. And that's what he sees in Edward Snowden, what Snowden has done 6 months ago to leak this surveillance information to U.S. journalists.
All right, now talk about SecureDrop, because unfortunately it seems like, of course, you know, the advent of the characters of Bradley, Chelsea Manning, and Edward Snowden on the scene, they sort of they make it seem like you got to sacrifice everything to do what they did. But in fact, Chelsea Manning did not have to blab to Adrian Lamo the rat. And Edward Snowden, he may not have gotten away with it. They may have figured out who it was and busted him. Maybe he could have found a way around that. But he deliberately chose to come forward to Greenwald and to Poitras in order to explain why he did what he did in anticipation of the smear job that they would try to accuse him of treason and whatever, that he wanted to state from the outset why it was that he leaked what he leaked. But on the other hand, there are millions, well, at least hundreds of thousands of government employees with access to secrets that should not be secrets because they're, you know, what they call embarrassing. What if a civilian did it would be called criminal behavior on the part of the government that the American people have the right to know about. And those people can provide those documents either to Assange and WikiLeaks or to other organizations without getting themselves in trouble and, you know, having to spend 35 years in the brig or anything else like that. So why don't you talk a little bit about how, no, really, we can protect your identity. Go ahead and leak.
Sure. Well, you know, as you've kind of just described, there's been this crackdown on whistleblowers for the past 6 years. You know, the Obama administration has unfortunately gone back on the president's campaign promises from 2008, and instead of protecting whistleblowers, has prosecuted more under the Espionage Act than all other administrations combined, which is just a huge number. And so, you know, for decades, reporters were able to protect their sources from prosecution by, you know, even threatening to go to jail or going to jail rather than testify against them in court. Unfortunately, the government has learned in the past few years that they actually don't need reporters to testify in front of sources anymore. So they get them, they subpoena their email records and their call records, and the journalists won't even know that this is happening until it's too late, and they'll be able to get their sources that way. And so we need to really, we wanted to develop a new system that will allow news organizations to better care for their sources and journalist communications. And that's what SecureDrop is. Basically, it's an open source, anonymous whistleblower submission system that any news organization can install. And it basically just acts as a two-way communication system, which, you know, if the source has documents they want to get the journalist, they can sign up through Tor, which is It's a web browser that's like Firefox or Google's Chrome, that anonymizes your web traffic. You can encrypt your file, send it to the journalist where it will sit encrypted where no one can get it, and until the journalist downloads it, and then they can go ahead and get information from you with sometimes even potentially not even knowing the identity of their own source. And even if they do know the identity, this information will be easily, we don't log metadata. Make sure that all this information is deleted very quickly so that, you know, the worst case scenario, the government's not going to be able to subpoena any third party. And if they subpoena the journalism organization, they're going to have a huge fight on their hands. And so hopefully we can kind of, you know, take the next step to protecting the communications between sources and journalists where we haven't really been before.
Right. Okay. Now, I saw where Glenn Greenwald gave a speech to the Hackers Convention there, and he said, you know what, legislation, keep your Dianne Feinstein, and courts, you know, if we're real lucky, maybe the courts rule in our favor a little bit, but what humanity really needs is for these, level 20 tech geniuses out there to really get cracking on building a secure internet for everyone that the National Security Agency is helpless against. That's really the way to fight back here. Do you think that that's really possible? Do you agree with that? That that's really the only hope we have as opposed to, again, appealing to the Feinsteins of the Congress to help us?
Well, I definitely think that Congress may actually be willing to make some changes right now because they've seen the outrage in their voters and they realize their job may be on the line. You know, there are a lot of bills out there besides Feinstein. Hers is absolutely horrible, but there are others that will actually make some real significant change. But we probably won't be able to get all the way there without some technology or help from technology. And so, you know, making a whole internet resistant, NSA resistant internet probably isn't feasible in the short term, but there are many simple things companies can do to make communications with people more secure. And, you know, we've been, a lot of groups like EFF have been calling on companies to do this for years, and finally now they're starting to do so. And we're also going to see, you know, there's all sorts of privacy businesses that are sprouting up, you know, promising that exactly the reason why they started was to protect people's privacy. And so, you know, hopefully, you know, as the months and years go on, we'll be able to better protect our communications, both technologically and with the law.
Now, what do you think that Obama's going to do? Everybody on cable TV news, anyway, is all amped up about this speech that he's given tomorrow. But this is going to be kind of minimal concessions, or he's going to pass the buck to the Hill, or what?
Yeah, I mean, from everything we've heard, it sounds like they're going to be very modest, watered-down recommendations. And remember, he was working from recommendations from the Presidential Review Panel that were already watered down. So these potentially could be almost nothing. And, you know, we're going to have to wait and hear what he says. You know, he could surprise us, but that would be a real disappointment. It sounds like he may pass the buck to Congress. And, you know, I think we should, it's important to point out, it doesn't matter necessarily, or, you know, it's not the end game what President Obama says. Congress can pass laws that are much more stringent than what Obama wants, and he may be pressured into signing them, or Congress can potentially override his veto. So, you know, no matter what happens tomorrow, it's not the end of the road, or it's not the maximum we may be able to get.
Right. Well, and it's important to keep up the fight on all fronts, if only for the combined publicity of all the different fights going on all across the board. And I really, I don't know if you guys are paying much attention to the Tenther movement there and what they're doing to try to nullify the NSA spying on the state level. But I think that's great grounds for great controversy and, you know, big fights over the Supremacy Clause and the Kentucky resolutions and all kinds of great stuff. So, you know, anyway, it's going to take a consistent effort, a very broad-based effort, where everybody figures out where they have a little bit of influence and see what they can do to play their role, you know. But now, I'm sorry, we got to hold it here, but we're talking with Trevor Tim from the Freedom of the Press Foundation. And when we get back, we got quite a few more things to cover, including a possible Snowden defense in court, were he ever to come home. Also, I want to catch up on the latest revelations, don't you? It's Trevor Tim from PressFreedomFoundation.org. Man, you need some new stickers for the back of your truck. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. Aren't you sick and tired of everyone else being wrong about everything all the time? Well, now you can tell them all what's right with some stickers from LibertyStickers.com. At LibertyStickers.com, they're against everything, so you know they're good on your issue, too. Whether it's the wars, police state, gun laws, the left and right, or the president, LibertyStickers.com has hundreds of choices so you can find just the right words to express your opposition and contempt for those who would violate your rights. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the thing here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Somebody said, man, you talk too fast on those commercials. And I says, yeah, but I got to fit everything in 30 seconds. And I don't like cutting stuff. And why did that cut off so fast? This is supposed to be the long version. Sorry. I will try to slow it down. We're talking with Trevor Tim from the Freedom of the Press Foundation. And the website is PressFreedomFoundation.org. And you wrote this great thing that I wish I could hit everyone on TV news in the face with. And it was this article about how if Ed Snowden came to court, say, you know, was renditioned somehow or voluntarily flew home and surrendered himself for prosecution, assuming he even got a trial in a civilian federal courtroom instead of the Guantanamo treatment. You wrote about what his likely defense would be in the face of all those calling him a coward and saying he fled to Russia, ignoring the fact, and especially the right-wingers, ignoring the fact that their political enemy, Barack Obama, was the one who exiled him to Russia and left him stranded in Russia. It wasn't Edward Snowden's choice to go there. But anyway, they say, if he's a real man and if what he did is really the right thing, then why doesn't he come home and argue that in court, Trevor?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we've been hearing this over and over again. It's the number one talking point. We every Sunday show, people who are critics of the surveillance are saying, well, if Edward Snowden's really a whistleblower, then he'll come home and make his case to a jury. But contrary to popular belief, he actually can't make his case to the jury. The way that Espionage Act prosecutions work against leakers are just incredibly unfair, inherently unfair. Judges in all of the cases so far have ruled that the leakers cannot tell the jury their intent. So Snowden will not be able to tell the jury that he did this to inform the American public because he believed that laws and the Constitution were being broken, which is a huge, huge difference than, a spy selling information to a foreign government and keeping it secret. You know, this was him trying to, uphold the Constitution, not stab his country in the back. And unfortunately, he wouldn't be able to tell the jury this information. The judge would rule it inadmissible. The same thing goes for the damage or lack of damage these leaks have caused. The administration hasn't come out with a shred of evidence that shows that this harms national security. Yet, the defense wouldn't be able to even tell the jury that. They wouldn't even be able to bring up whether or not the country was harmed by the leaks. The same thing goes with the benefits of the leaks. You know, he wouldn't be able to talk about the great debate that Edward Snowden has sparked, we're on the verge of major reform in the NSA and intelligence agencies. None of this information would be available to the jury. And so both of his hands would be tied behind his back, and he would have no way of getting a fair trial. You know, it would be much different for Snowden if he could come back and tell all the jury these things and have the jury ultimately decide. But unfortunately, that's just not the case.
Yeah, that would be the movie. Where the judge says, oh, I'll allow it, and the guy actually gets to put on a defense. In other words, what you're saying is they would narrow it down, and anybody, I think, ought to be able to see this. I mean, come on. They would narrow the question to, did he walk out of the place with the stuff? That's the only question you're allowed to consider, ladies and gentlemen of the jury. And so, yes, he did, and so lock him up and throw away the key. You know, come on. And it seems like anybody could figure that out too, even if they hadn't read your article along those lines. But still, it just, it's like blood on his hands about Julian Assange. Well, they just say it over and over again, and you're supposed to believe it, like the surge worked or whatever nonsense, you know?
Right. You know, I think there is a common misconception because people think that, he'll be afforded all of his rights, and when we, watch movies, like you say, about the courtroom where the defense is able to tell its side of the story, we assume that that's the case. And in most crimes, with most alleged crimes, or at least it is, the criminal is often telling the jury his or her intent if they're admitting to it. But here it's just completely different. The Espionage Act is written so broadly and vaguely that it doesn't leave them any room to tell the jury what you would expect and common sense would tell you that they should be able to. It's just bizarre.
Yeah, well, and especially when common sense would tell anyone in this country, any civilian of any description, that espionage is espionage. And whistleblowing, even if you disagree with it, even if you say, oh, come on, NSA spying, I love NSA spying. You shouldn't break your secrecy agreement over some measly NSA spying. Even if that's your opinion, it still doesn't make it espionage. It still is attempted whistleblowing on an issue that you don't care about, maybe. But it's still at least attempted whistleblowing. And so maybe he's violating his secrecy agreement, but that is not espionage. You know, it's a lie is what it is to call it espionage at all.
Exactly. They're trying to equate whistleblowers and sources to journalists with spies, and very disingenuous. Not only is it disingenuous, it puts the defendant at a huge disadvantage because they can't actually argue that what they did was for the public good or that they didn't cause any harm. It's just inherently unfair, and that's the primary reason why I'm sure that Snowden doesn't want to come back to the U.S. At least if he had a shot at a fair trial, it would I'm sure he might consider it, but it's just like impossible the way that the justice system works.
And yeah, I saw where Daniel Ellsberg had said, hey, back when, and they were threatening him with life in prison, it was only that because Nixon had put a hit out on him and tried to bribe the judge that the whole thing just got canceled. But,
Right, it's important to remember that Ellsberg was not exonerated. You know, jury did not
But he was out on bail. That was what his point was. Hey, I paid $50,000 or whatever it was on bail. But then he had months to sit there and hold impromptu press conferences on the courthouse steps and tell his side of the story and go on the Sideburns Guys show and everything else, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. That's another difference between now and then is that no way would Edward Snowden be able to talk to the media during the trial. He would almost certainly not
Dick
be allowed Cabot, out
that's
on
the
bail.
Sideburns guy.
And he would be, you know, held incommunicado through the whole thing. And so, you know, we would only be hearing the government side of the story. But just yet another reason why things have changed to the point where it's hard for him to get a fair trial in the U.S.
All right. Now, so here's the thing. On TV, they say, look, there's very little abuse. Yeah, there's some guys who are spying on their ex-girlfriends and that kind of thing. And yeah, they are vacuuming up everything, but they really aren't looking at it all day. And they really are just trying to protect us from the bad guys. And so you just don't understand, and you're just going off half-cocked. And so, Trevor, don't you ever stop and wonder, wait a minute, maybe I'm wrong, and these are my benevolent protectors, and I'm being a spoiled brat?
Well, first of all, even if we 100% trust President Obama and he is our benevolent protector, he is not emperor for life. In another couple of years, there will be another president. It is, there is a 50% chance that he or she will be of another party of people that you do not agree with, and they will have these same powers and they will use the same secrecy. But they may actually decide that they want to use these powers differently because there's no oversight and there's no way for them to get caught. We could see, the technology is in place, so we can see another situation like Richard Nixon and J. Edgar Hoover, which happened in the 60s and 70s, where they were spying on political protesters and civil rights leaders and well-known musicians and senators. That's what we want to prevent here. We should realize that, there has been abuse already. You know, the FISA court has said that there were systematic violations of privacy rules for 5 years, and nothing was ever done to shut down the program. The NSA claims those problems are fixed, but we have no idea because, you know, everything is secret. So this is exactly why we need oversight. It has nothing to do with who is in the office right now and whether or not you trust him or her. These are restraints that need to be put on any democracy, any leader in a democratic country to make sure those powers can't be abused in the future.
All right. And now, so I saw one that was breaking, I guess, today or yesterday, was about text messages. Was that not already part, I guess that's separate than the, and more substantive than the metadata, huh? And is that virtually all text messages, or do you know?
Yeah, there's a report in The Guardian that just came out right before the show started about how the NSA was vacuuming up 200 million text messages a day from all over the world. I don't know many details at this point, but, you know, it's clear from the article that it was untargeted. So, they're not just targeting terrorists. It's basically just a huge vacuum that scoops up all these text messages.
And then what are some of the other recent developments? Because, you know, what happens is it's now been half a year, and, you know, pretty much every one of these stories that comes out is a pretty big one in and of itself, but then they start to sort of seem old hat a little bit. I mean, shock us a little bit about the extent to which this has gone that we didn't know before.
Well, this is actually one of the first stories in the last couple of weeks involving the NSA. There was one over Christmas break where Der Spiegel published a catalog of NSA vulnerabilities and all sorts of products like the iPhone and different types of computers. Mm-hmm. An official said a few months ago that they think there's enough material for 2 years here for the journals to keep publishing. So, you know, I think we're still at the beginning of this scandal.
Hey, and do we know, tell me real fast, do we know that they're not recording all the audio or that it just hadn't broken yet?
Well, they do collect a lot of the information incidentally. So even if they aren't doing it directly, it's quite possible that especially...
That's Trevor Tin. Thanks.
Overseas.
Hey, Al, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. Don't worry about things you can't control. Isn't that what they always say? But it's about impossible to avoid worrying about what's going on these days. The government has used the war on guns, the war on drugs, and the war on terrorism to tear our Bill of Rights to shreds. But you can fight back. The 10th Amendment Center has proven it, racking up major victories. For example, when the U.S. government claimed authority in the NDAA to have the military kidnap and detain Americans without trial, the nullifiers got a law passed in California, declaring the state's refusal to ever participate in any such thing. Their latest project is offnow.org, nullifying the National Security Agency. They've already gotten model legislation introduced in California, Arizona, Oklahoma, Missouri, and Kansas, meant to limit the power of the NSA to spy on Americans in those states. We'd be fools to wait around for the U.S. Congress or courts to roll back Big Brother. Our best chance is nullification and interposition on the state level. Go to offnow.org, print out that model legislation, and get to work nullifying the NSA. The hero Edward Snowden has risked everything to give us this chance. Let's take it. Offnow.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. My website is scotthorton.org. Keep all my interview archives there. More than 3,000 of them now, going back to 2003. Also, you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /Scott Horton Show. All right, our next guest on the show today is our friend Peter Hart from FAIR. That's Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting at FAIR.org. Welcome back to the show, Peter. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing great. Glad to have you back on the show. And I like reading your stuff, man, and I like having Eric Garris run at antiwar.com all the time, too. Let's start with Ariel Sharon. How the big papers remember Ariel Sharon, and, you know, even if you're a very polite grandmother out there, and you would never speak ill of the dead under any circumstances, you got to make an exception for politicians. I mean, come on, especially brutal warlords and stuff like that, because, well, they're dead, and you don't have to worry about hurting their feelings, and history is important, and truth, fairness, and accuracy are important, and especially, you know, it seems to me, well, it's just a fact, right, scientifically speaking. When the New York Times and the Washington Post get something wrong, society gets it wrong. I mean, they're the agenda-setting media, as Noam Chomsky called them. They're the leaders, and everybody else follows them. And what they lie about today becomes history, you know, a week and a half from now. And so, you know, it's good to have people correcting them on the record, especially when it comes to topics such as the legacy of former Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. So, first of all, what was it, you know, that they said about him? And then you can go on with your correction from there, if you want, Peter.
Well, I think the best way to think about the dead is the quote that's always been attributed to Gore Vidal, of the dead, nothing but the truth. And I think it's a more honest appraisal of anyone's life, but particularly people who have a lot of political power and have really navigated foreign policy in a very profound way. And that's certainly what you could say about Ariel Sharon. A lot of the commentary and a lot of the obituaries are kind of curious because he's somebody who's been essentially gone from public life for almost a decade now. So it wasn't a sudden death, and you get the feeling that a lot of the obituaries were kind of prepackaged, and they could just pull them out of the archives. And that gave you a good sense of where they situate the important moments of his life. And in both of the papers, the New York Times and the Washington Post, I think a lot of the other coverage, you had references to these very brutal, very bloody incidents and tactics and history, but they were in the background. In the foreground was the legend of a man who was considered the father in many ways of Israel, a grandfather of Israeli politics, and in the case of the New York Times and a lot of other coverage, a guy who, by the end of his life, according to them, was actually pursuing peace. So in that context, you hear about some of these incidents that are not peaceful at all, and you think, well, you know, the story that they're trying to tell you is one of someone who changed profoundly. And there's not a lot of evidence that that was happening. The Washington Post said that this was, he epitomized the country's warrior past as he became the architect of a peaceful future. They talked about his brutally effective tactics. He was named the bulldozer. Well, why was he named the bulldozer? Because he would destroy Palestinian homes and refugee camps in order to make room for tanks to roll through. Why were tanks rolling through? You don't need to answer that question. I think you know the answer. So I think there was a lot of eliding of the history of Ariel Sharon, particularly when it comes to Lebanon, one of the best-known incidents, the Sabra and Shatila massacres, which he was held responsible for, even by an Israeli commission that was considered somewhat of a whitewash by a lot of observers. The stories are all there, and the facts need to be rearranged, because when you do that, you come up with a very different assessment of Ariel Sharon's legacy. And this was true in the obituaries, but then in some of the subsequent coverage, the critics of Sharon's legacy who were allowed to speak in outlets like the New York Times and the Washington Post were not the Palestinians who suffered, not the Lebanese who suffered from the invasion in 82 and 83. It was right-wing Israeli settlers who were still angry about Sharon's decision to withdraw a small number of illegal settlements from the Gaza Strip.
Isn't that amazing?
You look at those articles and you realize that's the debate that we're allowed to see in some of these media outlets. So you have one guy in the New York Times, a settler, who says, you know, he came to make sure Sharon was dead. That was why he was showing up at one of the memorials. What did Palestinians, what did Arabs think, what did critics of Israeli foreign policy think? It didn't matter. What mattered is we need to hear from people who would lionize Sharon's legacy and then people who would say he gave up too much. So it was sort of the right and the far, far right in Israeli politics. And it gives you a sense of, I think, how far the political discourse on Israel-Palestine has drifted in the direction of favoring a very militaristic Israeli approach, that we cannot have even a reasonable, fair-minded discussion of an extraordinarily bloody legacy of someone like Ariel Sharon.
Yeah, and you know, I don't know, maybe it's just me, or maybe, I don't know, with a little bit of help from you, Peter, people are starting to do better about stuff like this, because it looks to me, it's such, you know, the language here is just too cute by half. Oh, yes, well, you know, it was a very ambitious invasion of Lebanon. Yeah, in other words, he violated his orders and went all the way to Beirut and, you know, ruined everything and occupied the place for 20 years and sowed the seeds, you know, created Hezbollah in reaction. The Party of God grew up in reaction to his doings there and this and that. Oh, you know what? Let's call that ambitious. Good. And then brutal tactics. We'll change brutal tactics to brutally effective tactics. Mm-hmm. Oh, they were terribly effective, meaning just very, that's all. You know, no question about, you know, who is actually on the receiving end of the brutality anymore. And for me anyway, and, you know, maybe I don't get to speak for everybody, but it just seems so easy to see right through cutesy, coy little Washington Post language like that, that I start to hope that maybe that it starts becoming that apparent to other people. They start rebelling a little bit, that, like, come on, just say brutal tactics when you mean brutal tactics, you know? Why lie to me?
I think so, and I, you know, I'm hopeful about that. I'm also hopeful about the fact that there are places where people can have a more frank discussion of these things, and that the venues to have that discussion are much greater and, I think, more powerful than they were 5, 10, 15 years ago. I think it's obvious to anyone, if you applied a simple moral test, is would another foreign leader with Sharon's record be treated the same way by the United States, particularly of a country that was not allied with the United States so closely? And the obvious answer is no, not in a million years. So that, I think, is the most important test for how we have this kind of conversation. Foreign leaders who die who are much less controversial are treated far more critically. Hugo Chavez of Venezuela was loathed by everyone in the American political establishment, and certainly many people in the U.S. media, and the obituaries for him were written very differently. He was not invading and other countries and was responsible for the killing of hundreds of civilians, but the criticism of him, I think, was much more direct and much more fervent than what you heard about Sharon. The other storyline that I think is so obviously bizarre is the idea that Sharon was pursuing peace. Well, what's the evidence for this? The legacy that he leaves beyond Lebanon and beyond some of the other massacres are Israeli settlements in Gaza, in the West Bank, the West Bank Wall, and most importantly, you have the withdrawal from Gaza, and I think that is the area where people are suggesting, well, he had a mind for a peaceful negotiation. Removing a few thousand settlers from Gaza was a simple tactical move. It was, I think, pretty obvious at the time and obvious to most people now that that was not done because he had an intention of creating a Palestinian homeland that included the Gaza Strip. It was a more effective way of controlling that population and removing a small number of Israeli settlers in order to do that and relocating them elsewhere where he wanted to consolidate power. I don't think he ever stopped being a military man, in a sense. Mm-hmm. And this was a tactical retreat to win somewhere else. The idea that what has happened in Gaza since then is it was the path to peace, I think, is laughable.
It's and a rather worse sick than joke, that. But, I mean,
yeah, and that's the and I think criminal. That's the only evidence that anyone has. So when you see it, the current state of the Gaza Strip is his legacy. The current settlement construction patterns in the West Bank, that's his legacy.
I'm sorry, Peter, I got to interrupt you. We got to go to break. We're going to pick it back up on the other side of the break still on the subject of Sharon's legacy. There's a couple more questions I want to ask you about. And then I also want to talk about media coverage of Iraq and Iran this week, too. So it's Peter Hart from Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. That's fair.org. Hey, all Scott Horton here. Don't you want a bust of Murray Rothbard for your desk at work? A Ludwig von Mises for your bookshelf at home? A Harry Brown, a Ron Paul as a gift for a friend? Check out these awesome busts of your libertarian heroes at myheroesthink.com. They come in 6 or 9 inch sizes and now in color, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. I've got the Harry Brown one on the bookshelf in my office, and I love it. Just click the banner ad in the right margin at scotthorton.org and enter promo code ScottHortonShow to save $5. That's myheroesthink.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Peter Hart from FAIR. That's Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting at fair.org. And we're talking about Sharon's legacy and the media's whitewashing. And so I'm sorry I had to interrupt you for the hard break there. I'll let you finish what you were saying about Sharon's legacy of settlements on the West Bank and how the 2005 withdrawal from Gaza had absolutely nothing to do with guaranteeing a Palestinian state or anything like the spin in the Times and the Post you're talking about there. But then also, I wanted to ask you to talk about the way they tried to spin Shabra and Satilla, the massacres in Lebanon there, on Sharon's watch, as though he had been acquitted after the fact and found by some jury to have been not guilty.
Yeah, you know, both of these stories, I think, are instructive because the reporters who are writing these pieces are not unaware of this history. And I think that's the most important test of what kind of propaganda you're consuming. And in the case of the Times story, I think you could argue that it was a little better than the Post's because it has to reference these things. Near the bottom, you'll read about a massacre of hundreds, perhaps thousands of people in a refugee camp in Lebanon that Ariel Sharon was instrumental in carrying out. Now, were his forces the ones who did the killing? No. But that is not the issue, and I think that was the confused characterization of these stories. It was a Khan Commission official Israeli inquiry into this. The story was that these militias that were affiliated with the Israeli military carried out the assaults. The Israeli military was firing flares into the air to illuminate the refugee camps. Sharon, you know, this will sound very similar to some of our current political discussions. Sharon's case was that the camps were full of terrorists. You know, when you say the T word, then suddenly you're emboldened to act as you wish. And, you know, we have internal documents from the Israeli intelligence that have been written up in the past year or so showing that the discussions between the U.S. government and the Israeli government and Sharon himself were, I think, a lot more substantive as this was happening and right before it than we thought. And you get the sense that there was a very keen awareness of what was likely to happen when you unleash these forces in this Palestinian refugee camp. It was not a surprise, and Sharon could have stopped it. That was even what the Israeli commission found. So the idea that he was humiliated by this, I think, was the way the New York Times put it. You cannot think of another political or military leader who would be found personally responsible for a massacre of hundreds, perhaps thousands of civilians, and it being written up deep into an obituary as a personal humiliation.
Yeah.
But that's the treatment of someone like him in the U.S. media.
Yeah, that's crazy. And I'm sorry, because I think I said it wrong. I'm blaming the Benadryl, but it's my only chance. It's hay fever time in Austin. Sabra and Shatila are the refugee camps where the innocents were butchered there. I didn't mean to screw that up. Sorry about that. Let's talk about Iraq. The question of why did America invade Iraq 14 years later? It's surprising but not shocking, or the other way around. But why did America invade Iraq?
Well, this is all coming back into the media, and I think if you were paying attention to the press over the last week or so, you'd be kind of confused by this. But the story was that there were some Al-Qaeda-linked fighters who had taken over part of the city of Fallujah. And reporters who were paying attention to Iraq at the time, of course, remember Fallujah as the place where those Blackwater contractors were killed and hung from a bridge. Less well-known, I think less well-remembered, are the two very brutal sieges of Fallujah that happened in 2003 and 2004. The U.S. military from the outside of the city. It's really never been, to my mind, investigated very fully by the U.S. media, but the stories at the time were horrific. You had stories about half the buildings being flattened, hundreds of innocent deaths, the prevention of medical personnel from getting in, on and on. Because this was considered a kind of payback mission directed at hitting at what they thought of as the most important insurgent-controlled territory in Iraq at the time. So you have all of these look-back kind of pieces, and they're dancing around the issue of why we went to Iraq in the first place and whether or not the war was worth it. And what I found so intriguing is that this is all written from the perspective of the U.S. military and of veterans of that particular fight, whether or not they feel like their sacrifice was worth it. Nothing said about the hundreds of people who lived in Fallujah who were killed for absolutely no reason. Nothing about depleted uranium, nothing about white phosphorus, nothing about cluster bombs. All of this happened, but it's been disappeared from the memory of the Iraq War. Most shockingly, I think, is the failure to come to grips with the fact that the war was fought over a completely false story about weapons of mass destruction. So you actually had on ABC last week stories about the effort to plant democracy in Iraq being the reason we were there. They say that journalism is the first draft of history. I don't know what draft we're on now when it comes to Iraq, but it pains me to think, you know, when we're sitting around and we're 70 years old and we're listening to people recount the history of the Iraq War, what's it going to be at that point? I feel like the possibilities are sort of endless, but, you know, I can't imagine sitting around with my grandchildren talking with them about the Iraq War to spread democracy in the Middle East. Will this all be forgotten? It seems so implausible to us right now, but propaganda can be very effective. And when 10 years later the memory of why we went to Iraq and what happened there, when that is basically erased, what's to say that's not going to happen 10 years from now, 20 years from now? So it's a very, I think, frightening concept, and one that suggests that even at this point, U.S. political leaders and certainly U.S. media don't want to come to terms with the fact that the war was fought on false pretenses and those people died essentially for nothing. There was a big controversy, you know, with a CNN host, Jake Tapper, who was interviewing a veteran of the Afghan War, and he got into a lot of trouble with some critics on the right because he phrased a question and made it sound like what he was saying was these deaths were senseless. And he immediately had to walk that back and say, no, I never would say the heroes who died in these particular instances, in these battles, were anything other than heroes. I didn't mean to suggest that the war was over nothing. And I thought it was a great moment because you cannot, in polite elite journalism, you cannot say these things, even though I think by any reasonable standard, what he was accused of saying is more accurate. And I think it's a painful reality that people need to confront, but our media should be able to look that square in the eye and say, what is the point of the war in Afghanistan right now? And if you can't come up with an answer, then you have to come to the conclusion, I think, that there might not be one.
Well, and you know, the thing of it is there is no accountability outside of Fair.org and a few other places. And that's why these people, they can't help but get it wrong. They couldn't possibly get it right because they don't have the first idea what happened in the Iraq War. Yeah, you know, at one time some heroes went this way, and at another time some heroes went that way. But they don't know who they were fighting for, who the hell this Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, who happens to be the most powerful Shiite cleric in the world, is, or any of this crap. They don't know. Diane Sawyer doesn't know the first thing about it. So if the line reads, they were there giving people happiness or whatever, then that's what she's going to repeat, like on Stay Classy San Diego, where Anchorman, whatever the teleprompter says, you know, and that's because all the same reporters who lied us into war on behalf of the government, none of them were fired. And all the people who got it right, like you, or like Eric Margolies, or, you know, whoever, before the war, were trying to say, hey, here's the truth, and here's why not to do it, and here's why we already know that the aluminum tubes thing is debunked. Why do you keep saying that, and whatever? Y'all didn't ever get the job. I didn't ever get the job to replace all the people who got it wrong. And so they all just, you know, they just keep on going. It's the very same people. So, you know, I think it is going to be the history that, you know, the Iraq War was a sad case of trying really, really hard to help some people out of pure love and selflessness, but it just didn't take because you know what beasts those Arabs are, you know.
You know, not to link the two, but, you know, it's the same tendency that can write a obituary of Ariel Sharon and stress the fact that he was an architect for peace in the Middle East.
Right. Yeah, you know, it's whatever they call it, you know.
It sounds completely implausible, but we're looking at it right now. And so I think the two stories are alike in some ways. And the fact that, you know, you look at people like Bill Kristol, the neocon pundit, who was basically confined to Fox News Channel through all of these years. He's a free agent now. You see him on ABC, you see him on CBS. This is somebody who was completely wrong about the Iraq War, and he's asked to come on television and is likely paid nice sums of money to do this, to talk about foreign policy. Now, well, what on earth would you want to listen to him for? But this is the way the establishment works, and someone like him cannot be knocked off that perch no matter how wrong they are.
Right. And then, like your latest on the site, and we're almost out of time here, but same thing happens then when CBS writes a story about Iran's nuclear weapons program. They don't have a man in the newsroom to say, actually, you know, that line isn't right. You should rewrite that and get it correct. They're all wrong. So they get it wrong and they tell it wrong, too. It's not just that they're liars. It's that they believe lies. They
yeah,
know
and
nothing.
I think the list of media outlets that have made the same mistake is basically all of them. And it completely pollutes the American understanding of what's happening with Iran and with our Iran policy, and it contributes to the idea that, you know, a group of U.S. senators, perhaps a majority of them, could call for additional economic sanctions right now and basically torpedo what is a tentative deal to try to do something about Iran's enrichment program. This is the political establishment that we have right now, and they're aided and abetted in this by the media.
Yep. They sure do weave a tangled web, but thanks for setting us straight. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Peter Hart, everybody, at Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, fair.org. And follow him on Twitter, too. I think it's Peter F. Hart on Twitter. All right, we'll be right back after this with Michael Ratner from the Center for Constitutional Rights. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins? CashIntoCoins.com makes it easy and 100% anonymous. Just deposit the money into their account at any Bank of America, Wells Fargo, or credit union with shared branching, and then just email them a picture of the receipt with your Bitcoin address and you get your Bitcoins. A simple, clean, anonymous way to get Bitcoins. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. The Scott Horton Show. Here weekdays from 3 to 5 Eastern on Liberty Express Radio. You can find my full interview archive at scotthorton.org. More than 3,000 of them now going back to 2003. And you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /Scott Horton Show. All right. Our next guest, our final guest on the show today, is Michael Ratner from the Center for Constitutional Rights. Welcome back to the show, Michael. How are you doing?
It's great to be with you, Scott. Thanks for having me.
Well, you're welcome. Very happy to have you here, and I hope you'll help me if I'm ever politically persecuted.
We'll be there for you for sure. I hope it doesn't happen to you, but, you know, with this government, you never know what they're going to do next.
They're scary guys, these guys.
They certainly are. Wow.
You know, actually, it's the local police are scarier than the feds, if you ask me. I mean, those guys, they'll just shoot you and walk right away, high-fiving each other. They don't care at all.
Yeah, that's right.
Anyway, so let's talk about some whistleblowers and clemency here. Edward Snowden isn't the only truth-teller who deserves clemency. That's the title of this piece that you wrote at The Guardian, and you're referencing both The Guardian and The New York Times call for Edward Snowden to be pardoned. And that's a pretty big deal, actually, that the New York Times, especially, I guess The Guardian, we could see why, but the New York Times, even though they're publishing NSA revelations and all that, I guess I was pleasantly surprised to see them call for clemency for Snowden and that he should be welcomed home and that he did a good job and all that kind of thing. Maybe I missed it. Is the perception in the halls of power really changing about this guy, that maybe he really did do the right thing and maybe they could let him off?
Well, you know, I wrote the editorial in The Guardian because obviously I'm very pleased that two of the major newspapers, but particularly the New York Times, has called for clemency or amnesty, whatever term they want to use, for Edward Snowden. I mean, none of us would have thought that a few months ago. None of us would have thought that because it was top secret documents that he leaked. It concerned communications and codes and structures and all that kind of stuff. So it is pretty shocking that a newspaper, which supposedly is liberal, but it's not really, it's supported every war we've ever been in, does come out in favor of clemency for Edward Snowden. So I think there's a big shift going on, at least among certain parts of what the, you know, might call the liberal community in a certain way, going on and in polling across the country. And I think one of the reasons, which I stated in my article and others would say as well, is because what Edward Snowden disclosed was about the massive surveillance system on every one of us, you and I, this phone call, all of our phone calls, metadata, internet traffic, everything, just massive surveillance system that affects the privacy of each and every one of us, and billions and billions of phone records and calls. So we're directly affected by his revelations, and they haven't yet been able to show that what they've done has led to even the stopping of one act of terrorism that was imminent or that there was any really need to do this. So that there's a lot of support for what Snowden revealed, and there's a lot of debate going on, and it's caused debate. And Snowden himself has said in some way his mission is accomplished by causing that debate. The president is going to be giving a speech on Friday the 17th. It's going to be, I don't think, much of a speech. It'll be a good speech probably because he's a good speaker, but it's not going to say anything. It's really probably an attempt to paper over the controversy about the NSA and let a lot of the people think we're doing something. So that's Ed Snowden, and it has changed, and certainly a lot of the public perception. I think within the government, I still think they want to get Ed Snowden. I don't think they're ready to give him a clemency or a pardon. And we saw a recent revelation about Ed Snowden from the NSA guy who was in charge of the investigation into what harm was caused by his leaks, and that man, who may head the NSA, said, well, we might be willing to make a deal with Ed Snowden, but only if he promises not to release any more documents, et cetera, et cetera. And what there was an implication in that Ed Snowden still has a lot left that he may or may not have given to the journalists, I have no idea, but that this man thinks can be harmful. So there may be some room there, but I think the government is still very hard-nosed about giving Ed Snowden clemency. The reason I wrote the editorial I did was obviously I support clemency for Ed Snowden. I think what he did was crucial. But what I felt was missing from both the New York Times editorial and the Guardian editorial and from the public conversation we're having about Ed Snowden and was he a hero and should he get clemency, should he not, was all the other whistleblowers are out there. And there's a lot. There's two or three I focused on in the article. One is Chelsea Manning, who revealed the Iraq war logs, the Afghan war logs, the collateral murder video, diplomatic cables, huge amount of information about the criminality that this country carries on, particularly overseas, from torture centers to other places. Then there was Julian Assange, who had a grand jury sitting on him and WikiLeaks, you know, for almost 3 years now, perhaps 3 years already, actually. And he's the one who WikiLeaks published the material of Chelsea Manning. And then there's Jeremy Hammond, who disclosed the Stratford documents, which revealed private corporations involved in surveillance, sometimes hand-in-hand with government, against individual activists. And what I said in the article, that the criteria that the Times and the Guardian are applying to Ed Snowden, and those criteria were three or four, they were very clear. One is, were the disclosures that were made significant? And yes, they said in the case of Snowden, they were significant. And I would say yes, in the case of Chelsea Manning, Julian Assange, and Jeremy Hammond, they were significant disclosures that were very important, government misdeeds and crimes. That's one of the criteria. A second one, was there any real, genuine harm to national security in any real sense? Again, with, you know, arguably with Snowden and certainly with the others I've mentioned, Hammond, Assange, Manning, no harm, and the government itself could not actually illustrate any harm at Chelsea Manning's trial. So the second criteria for giving clemency, according to the Times, is met. The third, which is related to the first, is were the disclosures of value. And obviously for you and I and others to know that the Americans are running torture centers in Iraq is a very, very important fact that we ought to know and debate. The fact that the U.S. is carrying on a secret war in Yemen. Yes, we ought to know that. The fact that we're supporting corrupt governments, or were, in Tunisia, we ought to know that. So they had great value. And fourth, and the Times puts this as a criteria, there was no other real way of getting these disclosures out to the public than whistleblowing or publishing them. And in that sense, Chelsea Manning testimony came out that that she tried to go to her superiors, was never able to do that. They wouldn't take it, and then she went public with the material. So, the real thing that's bothersome to me here, and really bothersome, is that we see a certain high percentage of America, perhaps over 50%, running to protect Snowden because of the revelations about what they're doing to Americans, but not running to protect Chelsea Manning, Julian Assange, and Jeremy Hammond, about what they disclosed.
Right.
And I think the reason for that is what I've been indicating all along, is that on one hand, it's what the Snowden disclosures concern, what's happening to you and I and each of us, and we're concerned by that. And the Chelsea Manning disclosures, for example, concern what we're doing to people overseas, particularly in war, and particularly in this, in many of the cases, to Muslims. My conclusion from all of this is they all deserve clemency. They all deserve to be treated as heroes. They all deserve to be treated as truth tellers and basically lauded in this country for giving us what our government our government has not. And so that's what I think is missing from this debate right now.
Right. Now, Michael, do you know by any chance, are there any kind of recent poll numbers on Chelsea Manning and what people think about what she did in the release and whether that was okay?
No, I should look that up. I haven't seen any just have come across in any natural way across my desk.
Because I guess I just kind of assume, but maybe it's the confirmation bias of who I surround myself with or whatever, but I just assume that, yeah, everybody loves Bradley Manning, Chelsea Manning, the greatest American hero that leaked all that great stuff. Are you kidding me? And then I sometimes find that I'm surprised to find out that, oh, really? Everybody doesn't think that? There are actually people who side with the government? And that's the problem, right, is what we are doing to the Muslims. It's what the government is doing to the Muslims in our name and with our money, and it's horrible and it's criminal. And Chelsea Manning is a hero beyond question, better than Superman or, the Green Lantern or any of them.
What she did is extraordinary. What was revealed about the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan is really, really chilling. I mean, what she did was extraordinary, and the fact that she, at least by the major newspapers and others, is a forgotten hero is outrageous to me. I think the polling would not be as good for Chelsea Manning. The recent polling that's come in on Snowden that I've seen is sometimes over 50% have some support for Edward Snowden, which is obviously very good. But
and now Hammond, by the way, he's the least famous of the ones you mentioned here, but he wasn't just, you know, being a criminal, breaking in and making money or something like that. He was exposing wrongdoing in a true muckraking, Jeffersonian free market of ideas, First Amendment freedom of the press kind of a way, right?
It's outrageous. You know, he gave us such valuable information. You know, the main thing that came to me out of Jeremy Hammond's work with Stratfor and the disclosures of that private intelligence company is the fact that most people don't realize it, but the biggest problem here is private surveillance, often in conjunction with the NSA and others. But some 70% of the surveillance and dirty tricks, et cetera, is carried out by private surveillance. And that's what Jeremy Hammond gave us, apart from the fact that companies are hiring places like Stratfor to go after and look at what activists are doing around the world. So his work was very important, and he has really gotten the brunt of the government's repression, both he and Chelsea Manning. I mean, Chelsea Manning is doing 35 years.
Yeah.
Jeremy Hammond is doing 10 years. Now, hopefully, Chelsea will do significantly shorter. That's our hope. I think that, unfortunately, Jeremy Hammond will be doing a large part of that 10 years because of the difference in sentencing procedures. But they're heroes. I mean, these people are the reason this country now is having conversations about a lot of this stuff, about the Internet, about surveillance, about the ways we fight wars, about drones, is all because of whistleblowers and truth tellers. These are the people who are making debate publicly possible in this country, and our government wants to hit them with sledgehammers, sentence them to jail for as long as they can, and hide the truth.
Yeah, and you know, come on, it's obvious to everyone that these kind of whistleblowers are the last hope of a Republican form of government at all. I mean, even the Washington Post version of this world is that there's a gigantic top secret America, a whole new national security state you never even heard of that grew up after September 11th, far above and beyond what grew up even since World War II and the Cold War, and how, they have endless secrets that they're keeping. So how are we supposed to know anything? How are we supposed to hold them to the law the way they hold us to it all the time if we don't have the truth? That's all we got. Whistleblowers like these. All right. Well, thanks for your great work.
Thank you very much. I really
appreciate
your coverage.
Sorry, we're out of time.
Really important topic. Thank you.
Yeah. Appreciate it, Michael. That's Michael Ratner. Sorry, I rant more than interviews sometimes, but it is what it is. I think it's just CCR.org, y'all, the Center for the Constitutional Rights there. And the piece is Edward Snowden, the only truth teller who deserves clemency. It's at The Guardian. I think it might be on anti-war today, too. Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And I wanted to mention this thing. I think I lost it. Do I have it? Yeah, no. U.S. continues to stand by Bahrain. Chuck Hagel's pans to political reform in the Gulf must have sounded strange to political prisoners in repressive Bahrain, where he delivered his remarks. Indeed. Well, was it Admiral Mullen was on Meet the Press back in 2011, and David Gregory, someone must have whispered in his ear a question to ask. I don't know where he came up with a decent question, but he said, "Hey, so how come we're at war?" He, of course, it completely accepts their bogus premise. How come we're at war to save the people of Gaddafi and support their Arab Spring uprising against the wacky colonel dictator there in Libya, but we support the king of Bahrain against the supermajority of the people who are pushing for political reform there? They're not even trying to overthrow their government. They're just asking for some reforms. He didn't ask the question that well. But anyway. And Mullen, who was at that time, I'm trying to think now. I'm trying to think if he's the head of CENTCOM or he's the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff or is it what? Anyway, all these revolving doors and chairs. He said, "Well, look, Bahrain's our ally. Simple as that. We keep the 5th Fleet stationed there. It's a fueling station for the Empire. And if the king has to kill them all in order to stay the king and whatever, we don't care about that. What would ever give you the idea the Americans care about democracy? They don't care about democracy here. They don't care about democracy. Well, where they do install democracy, they only oppose their own creations. Like in the Gaza Strip. Or in Egypt. But the people of Bahrain, if they, it's basically, it's a Sunni-Shia split. They say, hey, it's not so simple as that. It's not? What do you mean? The king is Sunni, and the 20% of the Sunni Arabs of the population there, they all get gigantic welfare payments from the government and are part of the ruling clique. And then the Shiites, who are the 70%, or was it, I forgot if it's 70-30 or 80-20 or what. But anyway, the Shiite majority, supermajority, they're completely on the outs and have no political power and no influence with the king and no political rights and very few civil ones either. And so they said, hey, how about a constitutional monarchy with a parliament that has some power? Could we have that? The kingdom tortured them and beat them and shot them and prosecuted and tortured the doctors who treated the wounded from their attacks on the protesters. That's the American / Saudi counter-revolution to the Arab Spring in Bahrain. And I tried to interview this person, but she wasn't available. And then she recommended someone to me from Human Rights Watch, which, meh. They're useful sometimes, but other times, they're just warmongers. Liberal warmongers. And anyway, so I don't do nearly a good enough job covering Bahrain for you guys. I really should try to get people on to talk about this. You know who's good on this is Roy Guttman. And I got my problems with Roy. But he wrote some really good stuff on Bahrain, although it's out of date now, I guess. I don't know. But anyway, you know, I saw the Washington Post had a thing, 20 maps or 40 maps or something that'll change your view of the world or teach you about the world. And then they had, yeah, it was 20. And then they had 20 more. It was really cool maps. All different kinds of maps. Very interesting stuff. One of them was the last kingdoms and dictatorships in the world colored in red. And almost the whole world is beige. There are very, very few outright autocratic dictatorships. You know, one man, president for life style kingdoms or whatever in the world. And almost all of them are American allies. Other than Castro and Kim Jong-un.
But in the Middle East, every sultan and every potentate and every president, every king who inherited his kingdom from his father over there, they're all on the American payroll. And almost all of them only have power because they're protected by America. What a legacy, huh? And now that doesn't mean that your only other choice is to be Paul Wolfowitz then and wage war against all dictatorships, starting with all the ones you don't already control. You know, the last, Saddam Hussein and Bashar al-Assad, basically. The Ayatollah Khomeini in Iran. Those are the three outside of America's sphere of influence. Yeah, we're going to spread democracy to the Middle East, Paul Wolfowitz said. No, not to Bahrain, not to Saudi Arabia, not to Egypt, not to Jordan. We're going to bring democracy to the dictatorships we don't control. Oman, Yemen, Qatar, UAE, Kuwait. Yes, you will keep your sultan potentate. You will keep your, heir to something the British made up 80 years ago or something over there. What a mess. But anyway, this is at Foreign Policy in Focus. You should look at it. U.S. continues to stand by Bahrain. Amanda, you feel Summers. It's easier if you just go by Amanda Summers. Anyway, U.S. continues to stand by Bahrain. And boy, that ain't right. Hey, they're torturers. What if that was your job? Well, I got to go on a business trip. Where are you going? Well, I'm going to Bahrain to pay the king to torture people some more. It's hard work, but somebody's got to do it. All right. Important Iraq news here. Maliki has called off his attack on Fallujah for now. And they're going to try to do a repeat of the Anbar Awakening thing. And, you know, I don't know if Maliki is actually really going to try it. You think Maliki is actually really going to try it? To get along with the Sunni tribes when he's seen fit this whole time to just freeze them out? What does he care? He withdrew his troops from the whole Anbar province before. It's the Skiri plan, apparently. You know, the Shiites, they gotta know. They've won Baghdad. I mean, the Shiite parties in power, Maliki, the Dawa party, and them, the Supreme Islamic Council, etc. They've won Baghdad. They don't have the ability to lord it over the Sunni provinces. They have their alliance with the Kurds in the north, of course. But they don't really have the power to really enforce a state on the Anbar province, so why bother? Their only problem is the Sunnis aren't happy with being completely frozen out. So they're fighting back. And anyway, I guess Maliki, by having the Al-Qaeda guys around, that they make for a useful dialectic where he can go to the tribes and just say, okay, let's repeat the awakening thing. You guys be the concerned local citizens. We'll give you some money if you promise to fight the suicide bomber guys who are attacking us. And maybe they can pull that off, and maybe they can't. But they sure as hell can't just invade Fallujah and win. In truth, you know, I don't know how much longer anybody's even going to pretend there's really such thing as Iraq anymore. Or at least, you know, anywhere to the north and west of Baghdad. But in Fallujah and in Mosul, there have been uprisings by the tribes and by the Al-Qaeda guys. Maybe they'll work something out. Maybe they'll have a power-sharing type of agreement. But so far, this whole time, they've failed all of the benchmarks. Get it? The surge did not work. And so, they're still fighting. At least Maliki has the sense to not break his army on the Fallujah stone there that he can't possibly invade and conquer, so that'll save, you know, some bloodshed. But as far as a political solution to this, they had a Sunni vice president, Maliki indicted him. He had to flee to Qatar. Now, there are elections coming up for the parliament, and so I don't know whether Maliki will stay or not. Muqtada al-Sadr apparently has had enough of him, and Muqtada al-Sadr's got a hell of a lot of influence. Then again, Maliki is currently the head of the state, and that makes him the most powerful guy in the room at the end of the day, really, doesn't it? Depending on how far he's willing to go with that authority anyway. I guess we'll see. But, you know, there was this article that it wasn't perfect because I thought it didn't, you know, pay enough mind to the victims of the war, the Iraqi victims of the war. But then again, maybe it was just a matter of word count. It's John Lee Anderson in The New Yorker. And by the way, he did good work on the Libyan war back a couple years ago. He's worth paying attention to for that reason, I think. And it's called What the War in Iraq Wrought. It's hard to say for me, but there you go. What the War in Iraq Wrought. And just about the destabilization of the entire region and the touching off of the Sunni-Shia Arab Civil War again, and the Saudi-Iranian conflict, and the this, that, and the other thing. And it's good. It'll add to your perspective of, you know, a little bit broad perspective, looking back on the last decade of terror war over there, and especially the Iraq war, and where it's led us, where this point is that we find ourselves now. All right, thanks for listening. See y'all tomorrow. ScottHorton.org.